The title of this talk is Hanukkah, the natural, the supernatural, and here is a word that is not commonly known, the meta-natural. Right. That's exactly what we're... So let me explain to you exactly what the terms mean and how they relate to Hanukkah. But before that, let me just introduce the talk with a question. Now, the question will take some time. As a matter of fact, it may take about half the lecture, just the question. But through the question, you'll understand a lot of the concepts that we are trying to explain, that we are trying to bring out, and how they relate to Hanukkah. Now, everybody knows the way the Talmud explains the mitzvah of lighting 8 candles on Hanukkah. You know, it's to commemorate Hanukkah for 8 days. That when the Jewish army won the victory against the Hellenist forces, they came into the temple and they decided they must light the menorah, they must light the candelabra. But they had no kosher, pure oil. But they did find one container, sealed container of oil with a seal of the high priest, and this is how they knew that it was still pure. But the container had only enough oil for 1 day. And really they needed 8 days. They needed 8 days, by the way, because it would take 8 days to get new oil. Because according to our tradition, the oil was found up north in the tribe of Asher. And it would take 4 days to get there, 4 days to get back. And therefore they needed the oil for 8 days. And miraculously, the oil that was supposed to last for 1 day lasted for 8 days. And this is why we commemorate Hanukkah for 8 days. Now, there is a very famous question here. We say we commemorate the Hanukkah miracle for 8 days because the miracle was for 8 days. But in reality, according to the story I just told you, how long is the miracle for? For how many days? Well, for 7 days. So why do we commemorate only, why do we commemorate 8 days? So there are all kinds of answers to this question. This is one of the most famous questions concerning Hanukkah. One of the answers given by one of the great authorities, the Bet Yosef, one of the answers that he quotes is the following. They divided up the oil into 8 parts. And they put each day 1/8 of the amount. And so it should have lasted 1/8 of a day. And the way it came out, that each 1/8 lasted for 24 hours, for a full day. This is one of the answers. Now, according to this, of course, it answers the original question. Why? Because now we have a miracle for 8 days. Okay? Now, there are many other answers, like, well, the first day we are commemorating the victory, the miracle of the victory. And the other 7 days is the miracle of the candles. Many answers. But I want to focus on the first answer which I gave you, which is that they divided the oil into 8 parts. So now the question is the following. We have the following rule in the Talmud. Even if you deserve that a miracle should be done for you, you deserve it. You are a great tzaddik. You are a very righteous man. You have no right to appeal to God to make a miracle for you or to rely on a miracle, even if you deserve it. The words in Hebrew, Ein somchin al hanes. You can't do an action which relies on a miracle. Okay? Therefore, if this is the case, what were they doing by dividing the oil into 8 parts? They're actually relying on a miracle. They said, well, we know God will help us. We need the light for 8 days, and therefore, no matter what, there is going to be light for 8 days. Therefore, let's just divide the oil in 8 parts, and as long as we put in 1/8, this is our contribution to the miracle. The rest is up to God. Now, you are not allowed to do that. And therefore, what they should have done is to put all the oil for the first day, and this is as much as they can fulfill the mitzvah, the obligation to light the candle for one day, and then for the rest of the 8 days, well, whatever happens, happens. If God wants to make a miracle, of course. You hear the question? What right did they have to divide the oil into 8 parts? Aren't they relying on a miracle, something which you are not allowed to do? Yeah.
What they're thinking could have been, had they divided it up into 8 parts, is that we'll light it for a portion of each day, not relying that Hashem will make it last the whole day, but rather than have it last for 24 hours, it'll last for the 4
yeah,
hours.
But that you're not allowed to do. You see, if you have a mitzvah to do today, right, a full mitzvah today, right, or you can break up the mitzvah and not fulfill the mitzvah on any day. The mitzvah is that you should be lit for a whole day, today and tomorrow and the day after and the day after that. So what should I do as far as my obligation is concerned? I only have oil for 1 day, so what is my obligation? To light it for 1 day.
Let's say they had found a sealed container and it only contained 1/8 of the oil.
I don't want to go into the details. Well, that is questionable. Some say that to do a partial mitzvah is meaningless. For instance, what about if you have on Passover night a half of the obligatory amount for the mitzvah of matzah? Do you have to bother eating it, or do you say, well, if I can't fulfill the full mitzvah, there is no purpose in fulfilling a partial mitzvah? That's an argument among the sages. But even according to those who say, well, a partial mitzvah is better than nothing, everybody agrees that a full mitzvah is definitely better than a partial mitzvah. And a full mitzvah today is definitely better than a partial mitzvah today and tomorrow and the day after and 100 days from now, because one full mitzvah is my obligation. Yeah.
Why was the light the mitzvah?
Well, we know that in the temple, we had a few mitzvot. We had a few constant mitzvot, like the offering, the morning and the afternoon offering on the outside altar. Perhaps we'll talk about it. I'm not sure if we'll have the time. But then you had another mitzvah to prepare the breads. There was a special table where they used to put the 12 breads weekly, right? As soon as they came in, they could have done that. They could have put up the breads. Or they could have put the incense on the in the inner altar. Or they could have lit the candles. Those are all daily mitzvot in the temple, right? It is a mitzvah. Okay? Yeah.
What was the mitzvah for the light? Did that have to be
exactly. The light, it has to be lit.
Just one slip. I mean,
right.
The light had to be without being out.
Right. Full 24 hours. Right. Now, I'm just focusing on the opinion which says that they divided up into 8 parts, and then the big question is, how could they have done it? Okay? Now, there is another problem, and this is the question which will take a little bit time to explain. You know that according to our tradition, there was a major change in what we call the divine providence of God towards the Jewish people. That major change happened after the destruction of the second temple. I'm sorry, after the destruction of the first temple. Major, major change. Now, we are going back 2,500 years ago. As a matter of fact, we call the period before that the period when the divine providence was in the open. Gilui Shechinah. The divine providence was in the open. Which means that any person coming into the temple could have had a personal experience of closeness with God. And it expressed itself in different things, like coming into the temple and seeing the fire that would never be diminished. It was always there on the altar, or other things. There was signs of constant divine providence that was 100% open. This relationship changes. And it changes after the destruction of the first temple about 2,500 years ago. And we start a new era, and we call this new era the era when God covers his face. It's not anymore Gilui Shechina, it's not anymore open providence, right? It's a period of concealment of God's providence, which means that we believe he's still there. He's still looking out for us. But when you turn around, you don't see him looking out for us. We believe that he's looking out for us, but it's very difficult to see, to experience it. You have to look beyond the surface to see the hand of God. This is the new period, which is called the period of Hester Panim, the concealment of God's face. As a matter of fact, we have a day in the year that we commemorate this new relationship. This is the day of Purim. Right? The day of Purim, and the heroine of Purim, the heroine of Purim is Esther, and the reason why she's called Esther, says the Talmud, why we accepted her Persian name is because Esther is very similar to the Hebrew word Hester, which really means concealment, and this is what starts during that period, the period of concealment. This is why the whole scroll of Esther doesn't mention the name of God, because on the open, you couldn't see the name of God. You couldn't see God's intervention into events. Because if you looked at the events, you could have said, well, it's just a chain of coincidences. There is no hand of God. Okay? But we say, no, it was a miracle. It was a concealed miracle, but it was a miracle nevertheless. Therefore, we say, beyond the surface, you do see the hand of God if you are looking for it. This is why we call the holiday Purim, because the word Purim means lots, lotteries. And lottery just expresses the idea of chance. This is what we say. Something that you draw lots for is something which you depend, you rely completely on chance, which describes the new era. It's an era that events look like they happen by coincidence, by chance. But we believe that behind the chance is the hand of God. Okay? Now, this is why we consider the period as the end of the period of open miracles. It's the end of the period of open communication between men and God. Purim occurs in that last generation of prophets. After the generation of Purim, during Purim, there were still prophets. But after that generation, there are no more prophets by the Jewish people. As a matter of fact, the Bible, the Tanakh, our Bible is canonized. It's closed. No more. You can't add anymore. You can't subtract anymore. Why? Because the Bible is only open as long as the communication lines are open. But the moment the communication lines are closed, because God's relationship is concealed, you can't have an addition to the Bible anymore. This is why 2,500 years ago, it's the end of the biblical period, it's the end of prophecy, it's the end of miracles, of open miracles. Okay? Yeah.
I mean, you said Bible and biblical. Where does this word Bible come from?
The what?
The word Bible.
That's a Greek word. It means books. Book. That's all. Right. Now, when does the miracle of Hanukkah take place? During the second temple, right? A few hundred years after the period of Purim, of course. And if we say that the period of open miracles ended, right? So what is incongruous? What doesn't fit in? The miracle of the 8 days. That doesn't fit in at all. Aren't we saying that after Purim, there are no more miracles? That's it, because that's the beginning of the era of Purim, when things look like coincidences, accidents. So how can it be that all of a sudden, a few hundred years later, we do have a miracle? What is it supposed to represent? Doesn't it go against the rule, against the pattern? Okay? So this is the main question. This is the main question. How it fits in. So, let's put the questions aside. We'll talk a little bit about Hanukkah. We'll talk a little bit about the three categories that we mentioned in the title of this talk, the natural, the supernatural, and the metanatural. And then we'll put it all together, and through that we'll be able to understand what really happened on Hanukkah. Yeah?
How did the Greeks know that they had to destroy their belief in Torah before they found
it? How did the Greeks know? What do you mean? How do they know that what?
That Torah was like a power
that they have to fight against? Well, I guess they sensed it. They sensed that their competition is the Jewish ideology, right? That's, you know, that's obvious that it was a competition to their ideology. As a matter of fact, you know that Hellenism overwhelmed the world. I mean, they took over the world. The culture, the ideology of the Greeks took over the world. Even their language, everything, except for a small island, Israel. Israel didn't take it over. A few people within the land of Israel did absorb it, accept it, but again, not completely. Even those that became Hellenized Jews wouldn't do it completely. They wouldn't abandon completely Judaism. So what they did is to find a compromise within Judaism that would allow them at the same time to be what they would call faithful Jews, and at the same time to be able to absorb the Greek culture and the Greek values. Now, how you can do that is extremely, extremely difficult, because there are so many concepts and ideas in Judaism which contradict Hellenized ideas, the Hellenized ideology. But what they did was is to reject the oral tradition. They said, you know what? The way our rabbis interpret the Torah, it's not something that binds us. We can interpret the Torah the way we want to. So they ceased accepting the rabbinical interpretations and the rabbinical traditions. Now, the moment you do that, you know what happens. The Torah is whatever you want it to be. You can fit into the Torah anything you want, right? Well, exactly, which means that it's something that they started, and it continued in future generations. Well, what did the Christians do? The Christians did exactly the same thing. They accepted it, and they said, well, but the interpretation we will give. And what did the Karaites do? Exactly the same thing. And what did the Reform movement do? Exactly the same thing, which is something that they started, and that's the way it's going to continue until the final redemption. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, basically, it was an inner, like a civil war within Israel. There was an intervention from the Syrian Hellenists. You know, that Syria was one of the centers of control, but there was a civil war among the traditional Jews and the Hellenized Jews. Basically, Matityahu was the leader of the revolution against the Hellenism.
And he was one that killed the
Hellenists. Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, there are many, many, many stories of that, yeah.
Am I right in saying that by rejecting the rabbinical interpretation of the Torah, you are making the Torah itself compatible with any of the secular ideologies and outlooks and philosophies that have arisen in the wake of the French Revolution?
That's exactly, well, it's not even before the French Revolution. You can fit in anything. You see, the Torah without an oral tradition with it, right, is nothing. It's nothing. You can fit in everything with it, right? Right? You can say, well, it says in the Torah you should be circumcised. Say, well, it's just a symbol, which means you should circumcise your eyes. You can do anything you want. Everything. And that's exactly what was done. There is a very interesting story with Hillel. You know, that during the Second Temple, it says that a Gentile came to Hillel and told him, I'm ready to convert to Judaism, but I'm not ready to accept the traditions, right? The traditions not, but the Torah I'm ready to accept. So it says that Hillel told him, okay, so I have to teach you the Torah. Okay, you see, this is an Aleph. The first letter is an Aleph. Second letter is a Bet, right? Came back next day and he told him, well, you see this letter? This is a Bet. Second one is an Aleph. He said, what do you mean? You told me differently yesterday. He said, you see, without an oral tradition, if I don't tell you this is an Aleph and this is a Bet, would you know this is an Aleph and that's a Bet? Which means the letters are dead. They don't mean anything. They require, by their very essence, they require a tradition. So therefore, how can you accept Torah Shebiktav, the written law, without an oral tradition? Right? But that's the way it was, because without an oral tradition, an Aleph can become a Gimel. I mean, you're not bound by anything, right? Now, let's go on. Well, we have a very short time, so let's concentrate on the issue now. Remember, we said in the beginning, they chose to light the candles, the candelabra. Now, they could have chosen any of the other mitzvah that I mentioned before. That's not the only mitzvah you do in the temple. You bring the incense, you prepare the bread, you bring the offerings. Why do they choose specifically lighting the candles? Say the commentaries, because lighting the candles commemorates, expresses the idea of the victory. What kind of a victory was it? As opposed to the Purim celebration. The Purim celebration was a celebration of physical survival. We survived physically, because what did Haman want? Haman is Amalek, an Amalekite. And you know what the ideology of the Amalekite is? The ideology of the Amalekite is that the Jew is a Jew is a Jew, which means it doesn't matter what religion he believes in and what his ideology is. If he's physically a Jew, we have to get rid of him because his blood is poisoned. Right? This is exactly what Haman believed. He wasn't fighting our religion. He was fighting our existence, our physical existence. So when we won, we commemorated by physical celebrations. We drink wine, we eat food, we send each other presents. But the Hellenists, they weren't anti-Semites of the same sort. They were not against the physical survival of the Jewish people. As a matter of fact, they said, you can survive as much as you want. We have nothing against the physical survival of the Jewish people. Our enemy is your ideology. If you can give up your ideology and accept ours, then we'll be friends and you can survive. So therefore, our celebration is not for our physical survival. Our celebration is for our spiritual survival. In other words, the Torah. And we take the symbol of light as the symbol of the Torah, because the same way that we say, without light, you'll move in the darkness, you don't know where to go, right? Without the Torah, you don't know right from wrong, so you are walking in the darkness. This is why we compare the light with the Torah. So therefore, the victory of the Maccabees is the victory, not of physical Jewish survival, but it's the celebration of the victory of the Torah, of our ideology. So therefore, the symbol of the menorah is the proper symbol through which to commemorate the victory of the Maccabees, of the Hashmonaim. Therefore, remember what I told you. In the inner chamber of the temple, you had in the middle the altar, the golden altar on which they brought the incense. The altar represents man's relationship to God and his basic subservience to God. The table with the 12 breads, which used to be exchanged every week, represents our physical part, our physical nature. Bread, our physical needs. On the other side of the altar, you have the candelabra, the light. That represents our spiritual side. So therefore, they didn't run straight to the table to prepare the bread. They ran straight to the menorah to light the candles. Why? Because it's the spiritual survival which is important, which we are commemorating. Now, we know that numbers are extremely important in Judaism. They are never coincidental. We know, for instance, that whenever you find the number 7 in the Torah, you know that it has to do with a natural physical cycle. Always, the number 7 will always represent a natural physical cycle, because the way we approach it is the world was finished in 7 days. It's not that it could have happened in 8 days or in 6 days. It just happened by coincidence in 7 days. We believe that the number 7 represents what was created, a physical world, a whole system. Therefore, we associate with the number 7 always with a complete natural cycle. Okay, this is why we have the sabbatical year. We work the land for 6 years, and the cycle ends on the 7th year. And we have a whole cycle of 7 times 7, which ends in the Jubilee year, which is the 50th year. Now, what does the number 8 represent? The number 8 represents going one step beyond the physical. If 7 represents the physical, then 8 represents going one step beyond the physical. Now, where do we find the number 8? In circumcision. Circumcision, the 8th day of a person's life, he becomes circumcised. Why? Why the number 8? Because it represents something which breaks away from the natural cycle. Why? What does circumcision represent? It represents the pact between God and Abraham. What is a pact? It's a mutual commitment to something. That's what the pact represents. Now, we know what Abraham committed himself to. He committed himself to give over the tradition, his commitment to God, to future generations. This is what he committed himself. This is what the commentaries say, why Abraham differs from other righteous men before him. And there were righteous men before Abraham. What was different about Abraham? Abraham took it upon himself not only to be a man close to God, but to transfer that commitment for future generations. He trained his son, that he should train his son, that he should train his children to be the people of God. Okay? But he's only a human being. What guarantees his success? Only God can guarantee his success. That was God's part in the covenant. He takes it upon himself, God, to guarantee that the Jews will be successful, which means that as long as there are human beings in the world, there will be Jews in the world. Now, that obviously doesn't follow a natural pattern. The natural pattern is that a nation should come up, exist, come down, and disappear. Especially the Jewish people. They always had to go through difficult periods in history. And if you speak about chances, right, coincidences, what are the chances that a people, that in every generation, sometimes more, sometimes less. Sometimes they have a 20% chance of survival. Sometimes they have an 80% chance of survival. But in every generation, there is someone who is planning the annihilation of the Jewish people. So they survive once and twice and three times. How many times, right, can you survive a good chance of annihilation? Eventually, your luck has to run out. That's according to the natural law, according to statistics. But we go beyond statistics. Chance, that's statistics. The Jewish people go beyond it. This is why the survival of the Jewish people, which is represented by Brit Milah, by circumcision, is done on the eighth day and not on the seventh, in order to express this idea that the survival of the Jews goes beyond the natural cycle, the physical cycle of things. This is why the Brit Milah circumcision is done on the reproductive organ. Now, could it be done in any other part of the body? Why the reproductive organ? Because the reproductive organ is the symbol of continuity. Continuity, right? The symbol of continuity is the reproductive organ. Therefore, since Brit Milah, since circumcision, represents the guaranteed continuity, this is why it's on the reproductive organ. Okay? So this is what is represented by the number 8 in Brit Milah. The same thing concerns the number 8 in the survival of our ideology, because we could have survived as a people, but not as a specific ideology. No. Our ideology will survive with us. This we have proved when we fought the Hellenists, which was such a strong, intense, powerful ideology that overwhelmed the world, but it didn't overwhelm us. We considered that an event that breaks away from the natural cycle of things. Because normally, we should have been overwhelmed by the Greeks, because they had all the advantages. Their ideology was attractive. Their ideology was physically appealing. There was like a worship of the human body. That always appeals. And they had intelligence. It wasn't like the ancient primitive people that never represented a competition to our ideology. I mean, any Jew, until the Greeks came into the world, weren't really challenged by the ideology of the Persians, let's say. Even if they had intelligent people among the Persians, among the Egyptians. But it wasn't a real challenge to the logic, to the purity of Torah. Hellenism was a challenge. It was a system. It made sense and it was appealing. It had every chance in the world to overwhelm Judaism and it didn't. Right? That is considered a victory that breaks out from the pattern. Therefore, the number 8 becomes a crucial part of the victory of Hanukkah. Now let's talk about our beliefs concerning miracles. Now, let me tell you something which is not accepted by everybody, but this sage is considered one of the greatest sages in the last few hundred. a very subtle idea, it's a difficult idea, but this is what he says and this is his opinion. We usually assume that miracles happen, how? By God's direct intervention in the physical world, by God breaking away from the physical laws and changing them temporarily. This is what a miracle is. This is the way we usually accept a miracle, and this is the way it's been accepted by most of the sages. This is not the opinion of the Maharal of Prague. The opinion of the Maharal of Prague is the following. Listen carefully, it's a very, very subtle concept. He says, when God created the natural world, he created with it a system. There are rules, there are natural rules. And it's part of the natural laws that they can't be changed, they can't be tampered with. They are there and they are there forever. So therefore, by God creating them, he limited himself to the point that he will not intervene in the physical world, which means that in the physical world, in the natural world, miracles can't possibly happen. So where do miracles happen? Well, miracles happen in another realm, in a realm that we can plug ourselves into if God wants us to plug ourselves into that realm. So therefore, he says, it could be that when the earth, or the way it's described in the Bible, when the sun stopped, right? There is a description of the miracle when the earth stopped or the sun stopped, which means the people couldn't tell that the sun was moving. He says, it could be that it's something that everybody who was there experienced because they were all tuned in to that level, to the miraculous level, to the world of miracles. But it could be that for some people the sun wasn't moving, and for the person next to him the sun was moving because he wasn't plugged in to the world of miracles. Which means, according to him, that miracle is just a matter of where you are at. If you are at the level of miracles, then you experience a miracle. But if you don't deserve to be at the level of miracles, for you it just won't happen. Okay? Or perhaps God will decide specifically, intentionally, to break you out from the world of non-miracles, from the natural world, and raise you to the world of miracles. Perhaps it will have an impact on you. But you can't stay in the physical world and still experience a supernatural event, because the supernatural and the natural are mutually exclusive, says the Maharal of Prague. So therefore, as long as you are confined to the natural world, then you can be in the supernatural world. Except that we have the distorted idea that the only real world is the natural. That is a distortion. The natural world is as much a human perception as the supernatural world. Nothing is absolutely real except God. Everything else which exists, exists as a human perception. Time exists as a human perception. Space exists as a human perception. You can't say that time and space are absolute realities because God exists beyond time and space. Therefore, the natural world is not any more real than the supernatural world. Therefore, it's just a matter of where we are tuned into. We can be tuned into the natural world. We can be tuned into the supernatural world. If we are tuned into the supernatural world, we will experience in our reality supernatural events. Now, we will pause a little bit and allow for possible questions to this concept, which is extremely delicate, subtle, and difficult, and not accepted by all Jewish sages. It's one opinion. Yeah.
Could it not be, and this is one of the things that possibly the Talmud does discuss, is that Hashem, when he created the world, built into the system a...
Okay, I'll stop you right there. Because we are coming, when you say the word built into the system, then we are coming to it. Next, okay? Next, any other questions?
How do you this subject matter to the parting of the...
Yeah?
How you?
Okay, all right. So you have a question. How do we see, through the eyes of the Maharal of Prague, for example, the splitting of the Red Sea, right? What? No. They went into it. They went into it. They went into the water. Now, There are two approaches to it. There are two approaches. One approach is that at that time it was a supernatural event, and God chose to raise the level of the people who took part of that event to the level of the supernatural, which means that he transferred their realm. Their realm became the supernatural, and therefore they actually experienced the supernatural. That's one approach. Or there is another approach. There is another approach that it was just a great natural event programmed by God. That can also happen. Because if you see in the Torah, it talks about enormous winds. Right? So somehow you see from the Torah that the event of the splitting of the Red Sea could possibly have occurred in the natural world through natural laws, and the miracle is in the quote-unquote coincidence of it, in the timing of it, that there is such a thing. Okay? So that would be the approach to an event of that magnitude of the splitting of the Red Sea. One of two things. Either we were raised outside of the natural world, or it all does fit in through the natural event. As a matter of fact, I don't want to go into it. There is a man, a non-religious Jew, a secular Jew, who wrote a book explaining the splitting of the Red Sea through through a pure scientific explanation. Right? He called the book Worlds in Collision. Perhaps some of you are aware of the existence of this book. This is a secular Jew, which I completely disagree with his point of view. I'm just telling you that that was an approach. Yeah.
So it would seem, therefore, that the Maharal's view is that is the secularistic outlook.
Oh, I mean, it's a distortion of the Maharal's view, the secular outlook, just the opposite. That is the highest level of religiosity, which means the absolute belief in the reality of the supernatural. That this is what people mistake, the position of the Maharal with the secular position, just the opposite. The Maharal just stresses that our idea that the only real thing is the natural world. That's completely wrong. The supernatural is as real as the natural. And we live in the natural as long as we're focusing in the natural. I don't want to go into it at length, but it's the exact opposite of what you're saying. Yeah.
The example of the splitting of the sea, according to tradition,
The
entire world was aware of what took place at that point. Therefore, Hashem would have to have taken every single thing.
It's possible, or you take the other, or you take the other explanation, which is the event was so cataclysmic, so enormous that it affected the whole world, and it was part of the natural order. It was part of the natural order, right? Except that the timing is the miracle. It doesn't have to be supernatural. In other words, miracle can also be the... What?
That's what supernatural
means. The word supernatural means going beyond the natural, but the word miracle doesn't necessarily mean supernatural. Something can be a miracle if it just through its perfect timing. Just imagine that this cataclysmic event, which happens once in a lifetime, exactly happens when the Jews are crossing, and the moment they cross and the Egyptians follow him, between the last Jew and the first Egyptian, it collapses, right? By natural means, but what is it? The timing is an absolute miracle within the natural system, of course. Fine. Good. So you're saying God intervened. But what about if God's intervention fits into the physical world, in the natural world? The whole problem that we have is how can the natural order cease temporarily? Isn't it part of the natural order that it shouldn't? But what about, and here we are coming to your words, if it was originally programmed in such a way that it should happen exactly at this time when the world was created, right? The world was created with a program for the next thousands of years, right? What about if it was programmed within the establishment of the world that certain things should happen at this and this time? Then it's still part of the natural order. Fine, but that's no problem. The problem with God's intervention, I just want to clarify, the problem with God's intervention is not the fact that he intervenes. It's the fact that it contradicts the system. The system is the natural order. Everything must have a natural explanation. What about if it can intervene without contradicting the natural explanation, the natural order? Then there is no problem with God's intervention, which means it's not that the Maharal is a problem with God's intervention. He has a problem with the definition of natural. If God created nature, he won't tamper with it. Okay, it's getting, yeah, it's, if it's very short, I'll, yeah.
So what you're saying then is that, let's say, the 10 plagues and the parting of the sea could have been like a natural occurrence.
No, I'm not saying anything of that sort. I'm not saying anything of that sort. I'm just telling you that anything which breaks out of the natural order, right, if you define it as breaking away from the natural order, if you define it as such, then that means that we in the natural world have to raise ourselves to that order in order to experience it. That's all I'm saying. I'm not telling you that every one of the plagues was supernatural. It can be a miracle even if it's not supernatural. I try to understand this. It can be a miracle because of its timing, because of who is affected by it, even though it does fit the natural order. Okay? You don't have much time to... Yeah.
According to what you just said about Maharal, assuming the Maharal were living 13 years ago, how do you suppose the Maharal would have perceived a six-day victory?
Again, I mean, it could very well be that he would have said that the miracle was in the fact that the natural events took a certain shape, a certain form, which was completely unpredictable, and that is also a miracle, but it's a miracle within the natural order, and that's absolutely okay. This is an intervention within the natural order. Right, exactly. But let me just go on to a new idea. What are we going to do, or what is the Maharal going to do with the following concepts? Let me give you examples. You know that we have a tradition which says that there are certain powers in the world which we can't really quantify. We can't say, let's bring into a laboratory, duplicate those powers and those events, because it just won't happen. Because it has to happen in such a way, in such a specific way, with a certain intention of the person doing it. And the person doing it has to be in a certain spiritual level. And if he does it, then he can do certain things which we believe can be done. Let me give you examples. We believe that when Moses killed the Egyptian, he did not use any physical powers. He did not pick up a stone and throw it at someone. He didn't use a knife. He didn't use a gun, of course. What did he use, according to our tradition? Those specific powers, which are what? Supernatural powers, are we going to call them? Can't call them supernatural powers, because the definition of a supernatural power is when God intervenes directly in the physical world. But are there any powers which are not supernatural? They don't fit into the natural rules either, but they still exist. Something else. What about the point of view that Nachmanides has concerning witchcraft? Does witchcraft exist? According to Ramban, according to Nachmanides, witchcraft is an actual power. It works. The Torah doesn't want you to use it, but it works. So here we have two powers. The power that Moses used to kill the Egyptian through saying specific words, right? In a certain way, with a certain intention. Or, do you know the legend of what the same Maharal that I'm mentioning now? Did you ever hear of the golem of the Maharal?
Yeah.
Now, I would say, is it a coincidence? The same Maharal who says that God will not tamper with his natural world. I mean, it's not so long ago. Right? It's 300 years ago? What? All right. It's not so long ago. And there is a persistent tradition that the Maharal, in order to defend the Jewish community in Prague, he created a certain,
a monster
or something, but he used the monster in a certain way through the usage of certain powers. He wrote a certain name on a parchment and put it in the mouth of this robot, and in this way he controlled the robot. Did anybody hear this legend of the Maharal of Prague? Right, you heard it, the golem. It's called the golem. Now, what was he using? Was he using supernatural powers? Not at all. Was he using natural powers? Obviously not. If you can't bring into a laboratory and duplicate it, you're not using natural powers. We have a name for that something, those powers which exist They are not natural, but they are not supernatural, because it doesn't indicate a direct intervention of God. We call it meta-natural powers, which means powers that go beyond the nature but are not quite supernatural, because it doesn't represent an intervention of God which makes the rules, the existing rules, cease. Which means that when God created the world, He also created not only physical rules, physical laws, He created meta-natural laws. It could be that telepathy, you know, that people used to laugh at the existence of telepathy. Yes. But we know today, or ESP, extrasensory perception, today it's studied in universities already, because they say it can be a coincidence. But they can't figure out how those powers work, right? It could be that they'll never be able to figure out how those powers work. Those powers work beyond the level of the natural. You can't call them supernatural. We believe in the idea of the evil eye, which means that theoretically certain people can actually cause damage through their intentions if something bothers them sufficiently. If you bought yourself a new shirt, a new suit, a new house, a new car, and it bothers me sufficiently, then by looking at it, I can have an influence over natural events through those meta-natural powers. Which means events that cannot be explained through natural laws will happen because they exist in the realm of those other rules, the meta-natural rules that were created together with the creation of the world. Or, let me give you another example. We spoke about Nachmanides. You know that Nachmanides' opinion is that a person, if he would be in a very high spiritual level, if he gets sick, he doesn't have to go to doctors. Now, what does it mean? He says, well, if you have a physical ailment, if something bothers you, that means that something is wrong with your soul, because the physical nature is only a reflection of your spiritual essence. Therefore, if you don't feel well, go to the source. Don't treat the symptoms, treat the cause. And the cause is some spiritual flaw, he says. Therefore, for instance, in the Torah, if a man developed some kind of leprosy, who does he go to? To the doctor? No, he goes to the priest. Why? Because it goes to the source. Of course, he says, this is only for special people. But what about for the masses? Well, the masses aren't at the level of treating the causes. They treat the symptoms. They must go to doctors. So I'm asking you, according to Nachmanides, a person who is at the level not to go to doctors, what he says, the extraordinary person who can just treat the cause of his ailment, not the symptoms, such a person, what powers is he using? Natural powers? The natural laws? The natural laws is going to the doctor, take a medicine. What system is he using? The supernatural system? No. It's not a direct intervention of God. He's using the meta-natural system. Therefore, is he allowed to use the meta-natural system? Or is that included in the restriction of Ein Somchin Al Hanes? You can't ask God for a direct intervention because God will decide whether to intervene or not. You can't ask for a direct intervention. You see that the meta-natural system, if you have that power, you can use it. The supernatural system, this is up to God. The meta-natural system is just up to us if we have that power. If you are Moses and you control those powers, and this Egyptian is bothering you and he represents a threat to the Jewish people and to Jewish survival, go right ahead. You use your meta-natural powers. If you are sick and you don't want to go to a doctor and you have those meta-natural powers which allow you to get cured by treating the spiritual cause of the sickness, go right ahead. Do it. Okay? Or another example. It says that one of the great Talmudic scholars once wanted to show the people, he wanted to teach them a lesson. And the lesson was the following. The people had been attacked by venomous snakes, right? And many people were killed by the venomous snakes. So this great rabbi goes over to the pit where the snakes were concentrated. And he allowed one of the snakes to bite him. And the snake died, right? And he said to them, you see, it's not the venom which kills. It's the sin that kills, which means it's our human imperfection But if you can go beyond our human imperfection, then the venom wouldn't kill. Now, is he playing with the supernatural by doing that? He wouldn't be allowed to do that. You know that you are... Ein som chinaranes means that you are not allowed to use the supernatural. But what about if we say that the powers that he was using were the meta-natural powers, which means existing rules, existing laws, which work beyond nature but within the realm of nature, which means it's not a direct intervention of God, it's everything structured from the beginning of the creation of the world. That you have no problem at all. If you feel the need and you have the powers, go right ahead and do it. Now, according to this principle, how would you describe then the decision of the rabbis at the time? We must do something associated with the number 8 because we must teach a lesson to the Jewish people. The ideological survival of the Jews is not according to the just plain natural cycle. To use the supernatural, we have no right because the direct intervention of God that ceased a few hundred years ago. By Purim already, the supernatural had ceased, which means the Gilui Shekhinah, the openness of the relationship has ceased. But what about the metanatural? Had that also ceased? The metanatural is always with us. That's part of the rule of nature. It's part of the creation of the world. Are you allowed to use it if you're up to it? Listen, if the Maharal of Prague 350 years ago used it, if in the Talmudical period, which is already after the destruction of the first temple, they used it, can you use ESP if you have those powers? Go right ahead, as long as it's not witchcraft, as long as the source is not some kind of paganism. If you have those powers, they don't contradict to the Jewish law, go ahead and use it. Therefore, we can surmise from all this that the powers that was used by the rabbis in order to decide that we should split up the oil into 8 parts, because they were sure that they had the powers to allow that little oil to burn for 24 hours, what the powers that they were using was not the supernatural powers. They wouldn't be allowed to do it. What was the whole question that we asked originally? What right did they have to do such a thing? It's relying on a miracle. But what kind of a miracle aren't you allowed to rely upon? On a supernatural miracle, which implies a direct intervention of God, you can't bother God to intervene. You are allowed to use existing rules. But what about the metanatural rules? Are they existing rules? Yes. Can you use it? Yes. Can you do things that according to the natural laws are not understandable? Yes. Therefore, the miracle of the candle that was the oil that lasted for 8 days, and they did it by splitting it up into 8 parts, was not a supernatural event. It was a meta-natural event, which is still called in Hebrew nets. It's a miracle, but it's a different type of a miracle. And that answers the question that we asked. It answers all the questions. It answers the question, what is it doing after the destruction of the first temple when we don't have any more open intervention? What is such a miracle doing here? Because it's not a supernatural miracle anymore. Or when we asked, according to the Maharal of Prague, right, all those miracles, they only happen in a different realm. Not the metanatural. The metanatural events happen within the physical world when you are still part of that physical world. Only the supernatural, which implies a God's direct intervention, you have to be worthy of that intervention. But for the metanatural, if somebody does it, everybody can experience it. Okay.
Can you pray for that?
Absolutely, yes.